journalism is to question the prevailing wisdom. Question the prevailing wisdom.
Just speak the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
All rights reserved and affirmed.
Free all minds. These are weapons of mass descent.
These are weapons of mass descent.
Welcome to Uprising, a daily digest of independent news analysis, investigation, education, artistic expression, and activism. It's Wednesday, September 19th, 2007, and I'm your host, sitting in for Sonali, Deimori Soundararajan.
It just makes me stop and think.
Silence is not an option.
The Ravaging of Africa. We'll hear a one-hour special radio documentary.
Once again, I tried too hard to cross the tracks. Sorry if my eyes drop when the fellow mellows out. But I can't help myself, why should I?
This is Uprising.
Good morning and welcome to Uprising. We'll spend this morning listening to excerpts of Asad Assimi's new documentary, The Ravaging of Africa. The radio documentary explores 500 years of African imperial history at the hands of Europe and North America, from the early European empires and the slave trade to after 1945 when the United States took over as the dominant neocolonial power on the continent. Through the Pentagon and the CIA, the U.S. government has fueled over 14 wars in Africa. The methods employed include direct and proxy invasions, as well as arms transfers and military training. The U.S. has also used the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund to systemically demolish African economies and health and education sectors. This military and economic war enables the looting of Africa's resources by Western multinational corporations. This genocidal imperial strategy has killed more than 26 million Africans, but has failed to suppress the popular resistance. In Asad Assimi's documentary, we will listen to 28 activists from 16 African countries who were interviewed for the series. The documentary is based on Asad's award-winning article of the same title. We'll turn now to part one of the series. Part 1's focus is on the militarization of Africa, with an emphasis on U.S. warmongering in the region.
Nearly 80% of the strategic minerals the United States requires are found in Africa, including 90% of the world's cobalt, 90% of the platinum, 40% of the gold, 98% of the chromium, 64% of the manganese, and one-third of the uranium. These minerals are needed to make jet engines, cars, missiles, electronic components, iron, and steel. No industrial society can exist without these substances. Africa also accounts for 18% of U.S. oil imports, a number which is expected to rise.
Africa is the most war-torn region in the world, with armed conflicts going on in 9 countries: Democratic Republic of the Congo, Sudan, Ethiopia with Somalia, civil war in Ethiopia, Uganda, Chad, Nigeria, Morocco with Western Sahara, and Algeria. The U.S. has provided arms and military training to participants in all of these 9 wars. Washington has done the same in another 5 wars that ended during 2002 to 2006. These are the long civil wars in Angola, Sierra Leone, Burundi, and Liberia, as well as that in Congo-Brazzaville.
According to William Hartung, co-author of the report Deadly Legacy, U.S. Arms to Africa and the Congo War, the U.S. sent $1.5 billion in arms and training to Africa during the Cold War years, 1950 to 1989. This, quote, set the stage for the current round of conflicts in the region, unquote. He further points out that, quote, the military skills and equipment supplied by the United States are still being used by combatants in these wars, unquote.
Following the end of the Cold War, the Clinton administration undertook a wave of new military training programs in Africa. In the 1990s, the U.S. gave military assistance to 50 countries in Africa out of a total of 53. The U.S. has 4 different military training programs for Africa.
Since 2001, the Bush administration has doubled U.S. military aid to Africa and quadrupled U.S. arms transfers. In February 2007, Bush set up a new Pentagon command for Africa called AFRICOM. It is headquartered at the huge U.S. military base at Djibouti in the Horn of Africa, close to Saudi Arabia and Yemen. The base houses 2,000 U.S. troops, mainly special forces, as well as CIA operatives. Given its strategic location, AFRICOM's purpose appears to be control of African and Middle Eastern oil.
The most destructive case of U.S. military intervention in Africa is the war in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, the heart of the continent. The war has killed more than 4 million people since 1998 and destroyed the second largest country in Africa. The Congo is the richest country in the continent, holding the world's biggest copper, cobalt, and cadmium deposits. The U.S.'s proxies for this genocide are Rwanda and Uganda, which started the war in 1998 by invading the Congo with Washington's encouragement and support and have since been looting the country's resources and sending them to the West. Oxfam called this war the world's biggest humanitarian disaster.
Angola, Zimbabwe, and Namibia sent their armies to support the Congo government, and Burundi joined the other side. Thus began Africa's first world war, involving seven armies, which has further wrecked a country crushed by more than a century of Western domination. The U.S. has given arms and military training to all seven armies.
Rwanda and Uganda are the U.S.'s staunchest allies in the region, and Washington backed the invasion of the Congo, according to Human Rights Watch. Uganda received $1.5 million in U.S. arms and military training in 1999. U.S. Special Forces have trained the Rwandan army in counterinsurgency, combat, and psychological operations. This included instructions about fighting in the Congo. To keep the war going, the U.S. has helped the other side, too, with Zimbabwe getting $1.4 million in U.S. military training in 2000 and Namibia $500,000.
Mfuni Kazadi is from the Congo and is Secretary General of the group Coalition for the Cancellation of the Illegitimate Deaths of the Democratic Republic of the Congo.
And when the war started, they were ships of American at Mwanda. I tell you, it is confirmed by the Angolese. And that ships, its mission was to gather all the communication for Uganda's and Rwanda's army, which were in Mwanda and Kitona. You see, so it is confirmed. And also, when the war were going on, the American were part of the problem because their authorities said that the Congo is too big. Must be divided into four states. If the Congolese, if they can't find any solution to the war, so the Congo must be divided. So the resistance of people, that is why the resistance of people have caused 4 and 2 million people dead.
So you see now, the Rwandese were used like a puppet. They put them in face to fight for the interests of the United States.
Under a peace deal signed in 2002, Rwanda and Uganda formally withdrew their forces from the Congo. But fighting continues in the eastern part of the country, with Rwanda and Uganda using proxy forces to control territory and continue the looting. The United Nations has identified 85 foreign multinational corporations based in the U.S., Europe, and South Africa that have been looting the resources of the Congo as the war has raged. Those include the big diamond company, De Beers, the mining giant, Anglo-American, Barclays Bank, Bayer AG, Cabot Corporation, and the Canadian mining companies, Barrick Gold and Banro.
In an example of organized crime, many companies have funded military operations, thus perpetuating the war. The Congo War is a horrifying example of all three instruments used by the U.S. in its attempt to dominate Africa: military invasion, World Bank, IMF, economic control, and Western corporate plunder.
All the looting material have been transferred, have been exported to the United States for nothing, you see. So the Congolese have lost everything. And there was only The Hague last year who condemned Uganda to pay $10 billion. But they said we have no power to oblige Uganda to pay that amount. So that we say, if they have condemned Uganda, Rwanda should be also condemned because they
they were a party of the invasion. Why Rwanda should get away from that tribunal?
The Congo War has displaced more than 3 million people, forcing many of them to flee to other countries. Women have been particularly affected by the war. Rape has been used so widely as a weapon in the war that doctors cannot believe its extent. It's estimated that 250,000 women have been raped by combatants, the victims ranging from a 2-year-old to a 70-year-old. About 1/3 of rape victims have contracted HIV and AIDS. Millicent Okumu is secretary of the Federation of Congolese Abroad, an international organization with branches in the Congo and 11 other countries that provides resettlement services to expatriate Congolese. The Federation also contributes to reconstruction efforts inside the Congo, including raising funds for hospital supplies.
The burden on the war falls on a woman because the woman is in charge of the children, is in charge of everything in the house, in the home. So when a woman cannot run away and leave the kids, you have to struggle that you protect your children. The women are the most suffering people. Many women and girls are victims of rape. So it is not something which is a secret. It's well known that women were so much raped, so much traumatized, so much that some of them are affected till now. If it was a girl, he can't allow himself to get involved with a man because of the trauma that she went through. When a woman is raped, maybe you don't know the man had HIV AIDS, you don't know the man has STDs. So if you are raped and you're being infected, now that life has been destroyed. Maybe you're having a... you got pregnant through that rape. That child will be traumatizing you because this is a child that I got out of my will, out of my wish. Now, when you destroy a woman, you're destroying the community, you're destroying the family.
Since 2002, at Washington's insistence, the Congo has been subjected to a World Bank IMF structural adjustment program, which means that its economic policy is being set by these two U.S.-dominated institutions. A major effect of this policy is to legalize the corporate looting of the Congo. Under World Bank rules, foreign companies pay almost nothing to the government for lucrative mining concessions.
What the U.S. has done, they also say that you must work with IMF and World Bank. And when the World Bank came, they put in place reform, macroeconomic reform. They have made a new code of investment. In that code of investment, they are saying that if the investor comes, he has the right to repatriate the benefit.
So repatriate all the benefits?
All the benefits, 100%. All the benefits. So now we have lost a lot of mining, rich mining concession, for nothing. You understand? So, who gain? You find that all the company in the front in there are United States. You understand? So, this is a very, very systematic policy taken by the United States. Now, they have also made what we call code minier, mineral code. In mineral code, they said the investor can take up to 90% of shares. Up 90% of share and leave only 10% of share to the government. It's not investment. We call it pseudo-investment.
It's blunder.
It's a blunder. It's a robbery. With what are we going to build the Congo as far as the multinational have taken everything?
The objective of the U.S. is to gain control of the economic riches of the Congo. To do this, Washington first used war and genocide, and then the World Bank and the IMF, combined with the threat of a return to a wider war.
The World Bank said, this is the price of the peace. You should give up. You see, you should give up your company. You should give up your concession. This is the price you have to pay for the peace. We are like, we are used like slaves. We are just producing. They give you a small amount of money, but all the benefits are taken by transforming the material outside. You understand? I would like to see a Congo where people are in the work, working, they produce, and not only producing the primary raw material, but also transform the material in place so that they can sell and get more benefit. Because now, all what we are doing, we are just selling the gross product we gain, so there is no any benefit which came from that. All these raw material are being transformed outside. You understand?
Patrice Lumumba was the first elected leader of the Congo. He served in office for only 2 months. Because of his desire for economic independence, the U.S. had him assassinated in 1961. Washington replaced him with its puppet, Colonel Mobutu, a brutal military dictator who murdered thousands of Congolese and looted the country for 37 years in league with Western multinational corporations. Mobutu's reign continued the plunder and killing begun by Belgium, which colonized the Congo from 1885 to 1960. Lumumba is one of Africa's greatest heroes.
He was killed because of that. He was asking to give the independence, the economic independence. You see, that is the same policy now. If you raise your voice, you will be killed. That was the example to show to the Congolese that if you try to resist us, we are going to do the same as we did with Lumumba.
After 37 years of U.S.-imposed dictatorship and 8 years of a U.S.-backed genocidal war, the Congo is close to becoming the poorest country in the world, with 95% of its population unemployed and subject to chronic malnutrition. Yet it is worth noting that in spite of the catastrophe it has wrought in the Congo, the U.S. has not been able to achieve a major objective, that of balkanizing the country. Washington's military strategy has failed in the Congo because of the fierce resistance of the Congolese people.
The desire for mineral riches has led the U.S. to invade not just the Congo, but also Somalia in December 2006, this time using the Ethiopian army as proxy. Somalia possesses substantial deposits of petroleum and is strategically located close to Saudi Arabia. The invasion was coordinated and supported from the U.S. military base at Djibouti, which borders Somalia. U.S. Special Forces and CIA operatives at the base helped to design the invasion. U.S. planes and ships bombed Somalia during the invasion, and special forces accompanied the Ethiopian military into Somalia.
The Ethiopian army has been trained and armed by the United States, which is the main backer of Meles Zenawi, the country's murderous dictator. Washington plans to ensure that two-thirds of Somalia's oil fields are taken over by the American oil companies Conoco, Amoco, Chevron, and Phillips. The puppet Prime Minister of Somalia has proposed a new oil law to encourage the return of foreign oil companies to the country.
Ethiopian troops occupy Mogadishu, Somalia's capital, where fierce fighting continues between them and Somali resistance groups. The Ethiopian military has committed horrendous war crimes, killing thousands of civilians by shelling densely populated neighborhoods indiscriminately. As a result, 365,000 Somalis have fled the capital.
Farah Malam is chairman of Ford People, the third largest political party in the Kenyan parliament. He's a former member of parliament from Lagdera, which borders Somalia and is part of Kenya's northeastern province. Malam is both Kenyan and Somali, and an expert on U.S. policy towards Somalia and the Horn of Africa.
It is American invasion, but the U.S. role is everything. The Ethiopians were sent in by the Americans, we believe that, and they were too happy and too glad to do the dirty job for the Americans, do the errands for the Americans. So you could safely say that this is a genocide against the Somali people. So it's the American helicopters, helicopter gunships that literally pulverized them from, you know, so many kilometers away where they could not reach them. And that's basically what turned the tables of the war. And Ethiopian soldiers are there just to, you know, when the Americans do the damage from the sky, to, you know, finish off the rest. Basically, that's it. And to maintain a ground troops presence. from the sea, they're using missiles, you know. And American Marines who also, they land their boots also on the ground as often as they want.
To justify its invasion of Somalia, the U.S. claimed that it was looking for three terrorists. Halima Abdi Arush is Somali and chairperson of EIDA, Women's Development Organization, a non-governmental organization based in Mogadishu.
While you're searching for three people, killing and bombing millions of people is not fair.
نعيب وحا إمانا أيو أو أرنتاس أي كينيسو أي كتلقي كارتا داتكا نعيد إيغ إرادنا أيا.
This is what happened in the south of Somalia. The first day there was a big celebration of a wedding which was bombed. Many people from both families died. There were nomads who were moving from one area to another who also died. If these things happen, the people that they are searching for today, maybe they do not find them, but they can find them tomorrow because the survivors of that wedding, the brothers and sisters of the nomads that were killed, will become radical. They are starting to get angry against the Western countries, against the Americans, and they can be the base for terrorist groups.
As with the Congo, the U.S. wants to divide Somalia into several smaller countries to make the oil easier to control.
There's this massive and enormous oil deposits that Somalia sits on, and that's what America wants. So what actually the American scheme on this is to balkanize Somalia, break it up into like five small mini-states, just like the Gulf states, the Emirates, yeah, and each one of them to have a small clan or tribal ruler, as such that America now becomes the dominant power that can have a separate deal with each one of them, and have Ethiopia's military power on the other side to intimidate them all along, as such that they do not have any independence. Every clan can have a small oil field, which basically will be run by the Americans.
While it has tried unsuccessfully to destroy the Congo as a state, the U.S. has actually accomplished the same in the case of Somalia. Washington was the main force behind the disintegration of Somalia in 1990. During the 1980s, Somalia was the top recipient per capita of U.S. military and economic aid in Africa. Siad Barre, the country's dictator at the time, was a key strategic ally of Washington in the Cold War and got $600 million in U.S. aid. Following Barre's rampage of killing and plunder, Somalia literally fell apart. Barre's forces murdered 5,000 unarmed civilians in 1988-89, and in 1990, he was overthrown.
With no central government, Somalia descended into chaos and civil war. The U.S. backed one warlord after another for the next 16 years to foment war and division and prevent the emergence of a central authority. This fighting has killed 1 million Somalis out of a population of 8 million. U.S. forces invaded Somalia in 1992, but were defeated and humiliated by Somali resistance fighters. When during 2006, the Islamic Courts Union appeared close to forming a central government and ending the civil war, the U.S. unleashed the Ethiopian invasion.
Roolka kaliya ay ciyaareen waxay noqotay in ay nimanka warlordka ahay oo wadamada wadanka dhibaatada ku hayay kaliya inay kaalmeeyaan. Mar walba shacabka waa dareemay inay jirto arintaas oo Mareykanka arimaha ku jiro, waayihii hore waa inkiri jireen, markii dambana si toos ah u cadeysteen.
The only role of the Americans was to support these warlords who have brought all this chaos to the country. Americans used to deny this, but the Somali people were aware of their involvement, and in the end, the Americans made it clear themselves that they were doing this.
Markaas waxaa dhacay dagaalo oo aan cidna loogu abayeelaynin oo xaafadaha xamar ka dhacay oo kumanaan qofood ay ku dhinteen waqtiyo yar. kadibna ay dhacday arintaas inay fursad u siiso qof la arko qofkii wax fahmay iyo ma aragtay dadkii lacagta qabay inay kaalmeeyaan dadka hor yimaada dadkaas waxaana abuurmay gurubkii loo yaqiin ICU Islamic Courtiska oo si degdeg ah u guuleystay.
There were chaos in Mogadishu. Thousands of people were killed. That's why the Islamic Courts Union was created, to stop the chaos.
Halima's husband and brother were killed in the civil war. Almost every Somali family has suffered similar losses.
So you could safely say that for the last 16 years, Somalia was maintained in the state it was in terms of disintegration of society and state and not having a center or a central government for that matter. The Ethiopian direct interference, as well as the Americans had a direct interest in Somalia, but using a proxy, Ethiopia, directly and militarily. I think they don't want a viable central power in Somalia. Not just strong, they don't want any viable central power in Somalia. The U.S. interest is, I'll tell you, the U.S. interest in blocking that is that Somalia is known to sit on massive deposits of minerals, oil and other minerals too, including uranium. The Americans have tried for a very long time through their own companies to get concessions, but based on their own dictates from the former Somali dictator Siad Barre. You could say anything you want about Siad Barre, but he was a nationalist. So he never allowed an unfair deal between him and the Americans. He would say, if it takes 100 years later, well, let the sons and the daughters of the soil come out with the right technology and the right knowledge for them to exploit their own natural resources instead of you taking it cheaply from me now. Because there was a 70-30 kind of an arrangement that the Americans wanted, I think, through Conoco, which is an American oil company, and others. That's what I hear. But then he refused. He said, sorry, it has to be a fair deal. More benefits going to the Somalis and less to the Americans. Well, the Americans supported Siad Barre, but later on again undermined him. So there is very reliable information that most of the warlords who took up arms against Siad Barre also had the tacit support of the American center, supporting the warlords and basically going for this disintegration of the state and society. The sad part of it is that it's militarizing a society that essentially is not a militaristic society. It has better priorities in life. It has different priorities. It has economic welfare, education, development as such, and other things.
And that was part one of the new documentary, The Ravaging of Africa. This four-part series focuses on 500 years of African imperial history. After the break, we listen to part two, which will focus on economic decimation of the continent.
On Sunday, September 30th, downtown Los Angeles will be the birthplace of the first annual Come Together Community Festival. Through live music, food, dance, and a variety of organizations who serve the community, we will be getting to know one another while we reaffirm our love and commitment to this city that feels like it's slipping away.
There will be performances representing the many communities and cultures that make up Los Angeles from 2 p.m. to 8 p.m. on Sunday, September 30th at the LA Crash Mansion on 1024 South Grand Avenue, between West Olympic and 11th. For more information concerning performance opportunities and organizational or food booths, call 323-204-6722 or go to www.kpfk.org.
That's the first annual Come Together Community Festival from 2 p.m. to 8 p.m. Sunday, September 30th at 1024 South Grand Avenue. KPFK is a media sponsor.
Washington has fomented not only military conflict in Africa, but also an economic war through its agents, the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, known as the Overlords of Africa. The structural adjustment programs imposed by these institutions on 36 African countries since 1980 have devastated the continent, decimating national economies and health and education systems. Structural adjustment programs offer loans on condition that governments drastically reduce public spending, especially on health, education, and food subsidies, in favor of repayment of debt owed to Western banks. Governments must also increase exports of raw materials to the West, encourage foreign investment, and privatize state enterprises. The last two steps means selling whatever national assets a poor country may have to Western multinational corporations.
Under structural adjustment programs, sub-Saharan Africa's external debt has actually increased more than five times since 1980. This is despite the fact that African countries have paid back four times their 1980 debt to Western banks. In 1997, the United Nations Development Program stated that in the absence of debt payments, severely indebted African countries could have saved the lives of 21 million people and given 90 million girls and women access to basic education by the year 2000. The All-African Conference of Churches has called the debt, quote, a new form of slavery as vicious as the slave trade, unquote.
After more than two decades of structural adjustment programs, 350 million Africans live in absolute poverty out of 682 million. The number of poor people has increased by 75% since 1994. Life expectancy has dropped by 15% since 1980, and today is 47 years, the lowest in the world. 40% of Africans suffer from malnutrition, and more than half are without safe drinking water. Healthcare spending in the 42 poorest African countries fell by 50% during the 1980s. As a result, healthcare systems have collapsed across the continent, creating near-catastrophic conditions. More than 200 million Africans have no access to health services as hundreds of clinics, hospitals, and medical facilities have been closed. This has left diseases to rage unchecked, leading most alarmingly to an AIDS pandemic. More than 17 million Africans have died of HIV/AIDS, which has created 12 million orphans. 28 million Africans currently have HIV.
About 40% of African children are out of school, and the adult literacy rate in sub-Saharan Africa is 60%, well below the average in developing countries of 73%. More than 140 million young Africans are illiterate. Given the annihilating social impact of structural adjustment programs all over Africa, it's not surprising that Emily Sakazwe, director of the Zambian anti-poverty group Women for Change, has asked, "What would the World Bank and the IMF say if we took them to the World Court in The Hague and accused them of genocide?"
In Guinea, World Bank and IMF structural adjustment programs have left half of the people in poverty and 45% of them unemployed. Yet Guinea, like the Congo, is very rich in natural resources containing half the world's bauxite reserves used to make aluminum, the third largest gold and diamond deposits in Africa, and 4 billion tons of iron ore. Bauxite exports provide 80% of Guinea's foreign exchange, and the state aluminum company has been privatized, with 51% of it being owned by Alcoa, the U.S. multinational, and Alcan, the Canadian corporation. Most revenue from Guinea's main income earner thus leaves the country.
Under pressure from Washington and the International Monetary Fund, the country's U.S.-backed military dictator, Lazana Conte, cut social spending and price subsidies in 2006. This led to mass demonstrations against Conte, culminating in a general strike led by labor unions, which paralyzed Guinea in January 2007. Conte reacted by declaring martial law and unleashing the army, which killed 100 demonstrators. The general strike ended on February 27th after Conte agreed to appoint a new prime minister acceptable to the unions. Since then, the army itself has revolted against Conte, with soldiers looting towns and terrorizing civilians because they say the government hasn't paid their salaries and owes them $93 million.
Bakary Fofana is director of the International Trade Center for Development in Guinea.
Les politiques d'ajustement structurel, les exigences de la Banque mondiale actuellement ont fini par détruire le seul instrument qui est à la disposition des citoyens, instrument collectif, qui est l'État. L'État aujourd'hui est détruit.
The rules set by the IMF are destroying the state in African countries, which is the one common thing that the people have and own.
Justement. Et si l'État est détruit, c'est la justice économique, c'est le développement équilibré au niveau national qui sont totalement détruits.
The government is destroyed, the state is destroyed, and this represents a social and economic injustice.
Privatization enforced by the World Bank in Guinea has created its massive unemployment and impoverishment.
In most African countries, including my own today, there are no more national industries left. They've been taken over by privatization. It is privatization that comes in a situation where there is no local economy. There is no local financial structure in place for a local capitalism to grow and thus create a local industry. So there is no economic development. The fact that there is no local industry and there is no local economy anymore, the effect of this is that there is no income from the resources in a country that is going towards government. There is nothing for the government to take from the workforce and from the resources in the country. So the situation is very bad.
De 1960 à 1983, on avait plus de 200 entreprises nationales.
In Guinea, between 1960 and 1983, there were more than 200 national enterprises. These were enterprises set up by the state. These companies produced everything from shoes to medicines to juice, all consumer products that were used daily. In 1983, the government changed hands and the new government decided to adopt a new form of politics. The World Bank came as consultant and they pushed for the privatization of the 200 enterprises. Today, none of these enterprises, none of these factories are functioning. What is said is that the price for which they sold these was very, very low. What the World Bank suggested was that the government had to get out of the manufacturing sector and leave that in private hands. These enterprises were selling not only within the country, but also selling to neighboring countries. They were functioning well.
Ces entreprises autour ont disparu. Aucune de ces entreprises n'est opérationnelle aujourd'hui.
The World Bank's demand that Guinea cut social spending has caused the collapse of the health and educational systems.
Le taux de couverture sanitaire aujourd'hui est extrêmement bas, puisque la Banque mondiale et le système économique qui a été mis en place empêchent effectivement à la fois à l'État de pouvoir subventionner.
The level of the health system is extremely low. The level of care is very low because the World Bank is preventing the government from funding the infrastructure and funding the rebuilding of the sanitation and health systems.
Aujourd'hui, quand on n'a pas de moyens de santé, vous trouvez des hôpitaux où il n'y a pas de simple mercurochrome pour soigner les gens. Et vous trouvez à l'intérieur des médecins, parce que les médecins sont mal payés, on fait payer à des malades, justement, ceux qui ne peuvent pas payer, alors que c'est l'assistance publique qui devrait le faire.
When people show up at the hospital, there is such a lack of funding that there is simply no medicine. Doctors, because they are being paid very, very poorly, are asking people to pay them, people who don't have anything to pay with. These costs are supposed to be covered by social benefits provided by the government.
Sur le plan éducatif aussi, on en parle moins, c'est qu'aujourd'hui, nous assistons effectivement dans ce domaine aussi, c'est qu'il y a un manque d'emploi. Puisqu'il n'y a pas d'emploi, les jeunes sont désemparés, les écoles ne répondent plus à la demande justement de la société. C'est un déphasage, c'est parce que tout simplement, tout a été détruit par ce système économique incarné et mis en œuvre par, justement par la Banque mondiale.
The education system is also failing because there are no jobs afterwards, so young people have given up. Ultimately, there is nothing left. The social structure, economic structure and educational structure are falling apart. They are failing completely and the societies are being slowly destroyed because of this lack of funding and infrastructure in the countries, which is caused by the system and policies put in place by the World Bank.
World Bank and IMF policies have had especially harsh effects on African women. Sarah Longwe is from Zambia. She represents the regional organization African Women's Development and Communications Network.
Women are not represented at places where decisions are being made in terms of the resources, you know, how the resources are used. And also they are not part and parcel of how the political parties run themselves, because there are very few women in the political parties position. And because of not having a voice at a national level as well as at a political level, we find that the policies, economic and otherwise, have been having adverse effects on women. For instance, when the government started borrowing money from IMF and they accumulated debt, there was no decision made collectively, which included women, to say what we should borrow the money for and how we should use it. And when the debt accumulated, women have been the ones mopping up because of these subsidies have been removed from education, from health, from roads, and these are the very areas which affect women. So women actually have been the ones who have done the subsidies for the economy.
Trade liberalization, extensive privatization, and cuts to health and education spending forced on Zambia by the World Bank have killed tens of thousands of people and made the economy collapse. Zambia holds 10% of the world's copper, which is the country's main income earner. The privatization of copper mines and other enterprises has caused such massive unemployment that only 500,000 Zambians are formally employed out of a population of 11 million. This incredible unemployment has forced women and children into prostitution, which has fueled the AIDS pandemic and created yet more hardship for women. Zambia's life expectancy today is 33 years, the lowest of any country in the world.
People who used to think that they had enough income, they don't have income anymore, and they are totally demoralized, and they've been depression, especially among the men, because to find that they are totally dependent on their wives, and then the wife, what she's doing to keep everybody together is inhuman, to the extent that she has to go early in the morning to the outskirts to buy vegetables and get back, and in between she has to pay the go-betweeners, which would include having sex for the services, or actually the family taking the kids to go in the streets and have sex so they can bring money.
With the kids? Sex with
the
kids?
The kids have to go out also to get an income. So kids have become stealing, or they become sexually abused if they can be given money. And also that has other effects of drugs, you know, because they're doing things which are really bad and to themselves. So there's a lot of glue sniffing. It's very different from the West, because you use drugs which you can, cocaine and things, although there are some who do that, but people have created other form of drugs to forget hunger, to forget the inhuman things they are doing. So they sniff glue, they make the, if I would call it glue, because initially they were sniffing glue, but now they've found a way of creating this, you know, different petroleum, different chemicals, you know, they mix, it could be paraffin, and then it gets into a strong mixture, and they sniff that, and it for a while it takes all the misery away.
The devastating HIV/AIDS pandemic in Zambia has been declared a national emergency by the government. 17% of Zambians are HIV positive, and there are over 700,000 children who are AIDS orphans.
Some also traditional cons have come into play, and have even come with even worse things, you know, like for instance, you can be cured for AIDS if you sleep with a virgin, if you sleep with somebody who is 70 years old. So nowadays there are gang rapes of little kids, gang rapes of old women.
World Bank mandated trade liberalization has destroyed the agricultural sector also, thereby causing the expansion of urban slums as well as encouraging the spread of HIV/AIDS. By allowing cheap crop and food imports into African countries, trade liberalization has displaced local farmers who cannot compete. Many such men are forced to move to urban slums for work, where they get infected with HIV due to unprotected sex, and then spread the disease to their wives in their home village. In Kenya's capital, Nairobi, about 60% of the population lives in slums.
Caroline Adeyambo is a resident of Madare, one of Nairobi's oldest slums, where she works as a volunteer with the Madare Mothers Development Center. Caroline is a home-based caregiver who takes care of HIV/AIDS patients.
You know, we as volunteers, we are the ones overburdened with work. The health caregivers are doing nothing at all, because they wait for their salary at the end of the month. Whether there is a sick person there, they don't care. It is upon us, we caregivers, to go and take care of the sick person in the hospital as well as back at home. I give care to the bedridden patients who are living positively or without AIDS or with AIDS. As volunteers, we take them to the hospitals, we look for the relatives if they are near, we dedicate the one to the relatives so that we don't get overburdened. But you know, it comes to a time when we have to go back to our pockets, because when you go to visit a patient, sometimes you find there's nothing, completely nothing in the house. So you have to go back to your pocket, produce some little cash to help the patient. In the other hand, you are not employed. You also, at your side, you have a need. So it becomes difficult there. And otherwise, we are happy because we are happy to see our fellow friends improve and they are back to life again.
Kenya has only one national referral hospital, the Kenyatta National Hospital, in a country of over 31 million people. The combined effect of the AIDS epidemic and tuberculosis on Kenya has been catastrophic, given the destruction of the health system by World Bank-sanctioned cutbacks. More than half of Kenya's hospital beds are occupied by patients with HIV/AIDS-related infections, and life expectancy in the country has been reduced to 48 years.
Kenya was the first country in Africa to come under a World Bank Structural Adjustment Program in 1980. After 27 years of adjustment, more than half of the population lives in poverty, and Kenya is 148 out of 177 countries on the United Nations Development Program's Human Development Index, which measures a nation's development in terms of life expectancy, education, and standard of living. Most Kenyans consume less food calories today than they did 30 years ago. Under World Bank IMF pressure, the Kenyan government has recently privatized Kenya Railways, resulting in the layoff of 4,000 workers.
Njoki Gitetwa is coordinator of Kenya Debt Relief Network.
IMF and World Bank in this country, with their structural adjustment program, has completely destroyed the social fabric of this country. What is important is that is the insistence that workers must be sacked. You increase employment in a country that is trying to generate employment. You increase frustrations in a country which is trying to hold together the social fabric. You increase social turmoil in a country that is supposed to be stable. Because once you destroy, you sack somebody from jobs, what you're doing in effect is to tell that country to go to hell and suffer. You're causing social breakdown.
The World Bank is insisting on even privatizing as essential a resource as Kenya's water, in spite of the disastrous consequences of this policy all over the world. These include sharp price increases, greater unemployment, corruption, and severe declines in accessibility, service, and quality. Already, only 14% of Kenyan households have piped in water.
Through privatization, the World Bank has encouraged massive corruption in Africa and the rest of the South. As author Sue Hawley explains in her report on corruption written for the British NGO Corner House, the growth of corruption across the globe is largely the result of rapid privatization of public enterprises, along with the reforms to downsize and undervalue civil services pushed on developing countries by the World Bank, the IMF, and Western governments supporting their transnational corporations. Hawley estimates that Western corporations pay $80 billion in bribes a year.
Joseph Stiglitz, former chief economist at the World Bank, called privatization briberization. He spoke about how some politicians gladly sold their electricity and water companies. You could see their eyes widen, he said, at the possibility of commissions for shaving a few billion off the sale price.
Kenya's U.S.-backed ruling class is well known for its astounding corruption, especially in the era of President Daniel Arap Moi, who ruled for 24 years. Moi set up a kleptocracy and assassinated and tortured his opponents. Under him, the Kenyan elite and Western multinationals monopolized Kenya's wealth, making it one of the most unequal nations in the world. The richest 10% of the population control almost half of Kenyan wealth, while the poorest 10% have only 1%. Under the direction of the World Bank, privatization became another mechanism of corruption to increase the wealth of the elite and Western companies.
Mwai Kibaki, the current president, has been beset by two major corruption scandals that have forced the resignation of three of his ministers. Beginning in 1992, on the insistence of Western governments and the World Bank, the Kenyan government put up 207 companies for sale in one of the biggest privatizations in Africa. Many companies have been sold far below their market value, resulting in enormous losses to the state. Not only has the World Bank encouraged corruption in Kenya, it has directly participated in it. In May 2002, the bank's officer in charge of Kenya's roads program pleaded guilty to bribery.
For example, a company like a telecommunication industry is privatized. Once a company like Kenya Airways is privatized, once anything is privatized, it is always a player. It's always an interplay of strategic forces and interest to take control of that given industry. We have seen industries in this country which were privatized when the business class and some people in the business class are very well prepared. We are talking about situations where they are privatized when multinationals are very, very much aware. So the people who come exactly take these industries is not even the people. It's strategic players in the corporate world. And this corporate world, they part with a lot of money to support operatives within the government. It means that there was a lot of resources and interests that were exchanged basically to tilt the balance and to generate corruption and bad governance.
Since most African countries are largely agricultural, the distribution of land is the most important economic issue on the continent. In South Africa, 13 years after the end of formal apartheid, a tiny white elite still owns most of the land, while millions of black farmers are landless. 87% of South Africa's land is owned by white, Dutch, and British colonizers, as well as by foreigners living outside the country. Many of these are multinational corporations such as Anglo-American, De Beers, and Monsanto. Whites make up 12% of South Africa's population.
The World Bank is setting South Africa's land policy and has told the African National Congress government not to expropriate land or it will be economically punished. The bank insists that the decision to sell land should be up to the owners and the government should pay the high prices that they demand. Mainly because of the denial of land, 61% of black South Africans live in poverty, and close to 40% of all South Africans are unemployed. Archbishop Desmond Tutu has warned, quote, "We are sitting on a powder keg," unquote.
Molefe Pilane is an organizer for the Landless People's Movement in South Africa.
We created this organization after we realized that the issue of land in South Africa has been ignored even by the new rulers of South Africa who won independence in 1994 from the colonizers, the Dutch colonizers. They were then advised by the World Bank and the IMF to say that they should not take the land which was taken from the indigenous people in the past. They should not take it away from the colonizers, but instead they should use money, the state coffers, to actually buy the land from the colonizers or the settlers. So some of the settlers have been pushing the prices of the land deliberately high, knowing that they will make profit out of that. So the process has actually stopped, because the government does not have enough resources to buy the land. But also, if they try to amend the law to say that they're going to maybe expropriate some of the land, the value of the rand, which is our currency, collapses because of the international, you know, connections of the IMF and the World Bank and the multinationals. So that's the situation that we find ourselves, that the multinationals, the U.S., through its agencies of the IMF and the World Bank, is forcing African countries to actually buy land which was taken by the settlers with high prices.
The South African Landless People's Movement's tactics focus on education.
So that's a very difficult situation that we find ourselves in. But the resistance has been there. We've been organizing people around the issue of land and educating people about how land is important so that it can help them to grow food, to take them out of poverty. people are starting to understand that they have to stand up on their own and confront this U.S. imperialism that has been, you know, pushed down their throat through their agencies of IMF and the World Bank and other international monetary agencies.
That was part two of Asad Assimi's new documentary, The Ravaging of Africa. You've been listening to Uprising. Gabriel San Roman is our producer and Teddy Robinson is our engineer. You can hear an audio stream of today's program after 10 a.m. on our website. Uprising's website can be found via kpfk.org. Just click on programs in the left column, scroll all the way down until you find Uprising's website. CDs of the show are available at www.pacificaradioarchives.org or by calling 1-800-735-0230. Our email is mail@uprisingradio.org. I'm your host and producer, sitting in for Sonali Kohatkar, Temoy Sandar Rajan, and thanks for listening.